Hello and welcome to this podcast on the Building Safety Act, which was recorded as part of our Wales and the West Spotlight event held in Bristol in July. We hosted this event for our customers, partners and colleagues as an opportunity to discuss the implications of the Building Safety Act and offer an opportunity to answer questions. Looking at the construction industry now, it's interesting to see that over the last 12 months, we have seen people's opinion on the sector move from a feeling of uncertainty and witnessing a volatile market to a more positive outlook looking forward. We are more hopeful and optimistic, but we are facing some more challenges. Increased interest rates, which are going to affect lending and funding, skills and labour shortages, sustainability and environmental impacts, and productivity and efficiency is still very low for our sector, just to name but a few. However, one of the biggest challenges is that we are becoming a more regulated industry. It is completely necessary and will improve our industry. However, we need to work together to understand what this means for all parties. Collaboration is needed now more than ever. We need to work together as clients, consultants, contractors, supply chain partners, and government bodies to really make this work. In this podcast, you will hear a panel of experts discussing a variety of issues and questions around the Building Safety Act, from insurance to procurement. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need any more information, then please visit our website on www.wilmotdixon.co.uk. Thank you. I'm just going to introduce now, obviously, Neil Stevens and Nigel Gregory, who are going to host our discussion time. Over to you, Neil.
Thanks, Gemma. And so we've got a panel here from very different sectors, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves one by one now about, you know, who they are, where they're from, and what their specialism is with regards to the safety aspect. Okay. Jez, can I start with you, please?
Yep. I don't know if you can all hear me. My name's Jez Saldes. I work for our national product team at Wilmot Dixon. So it's a team that's set up centrally, and there's only a small group of us, and we're specialists in looking after things and keeping abreast of current regulations and what's coming over the hill. We look after our yellow book, and as mentioned already, we review every single project that comes into the business, and that's not just from a fire safety perspective, that's from a building safety perspective. So that's me, thank you.
Richard Glazard, I'm Head of Health and Safety Services for the London South East region of Fayton and Gould. My sort of journey, I suppose, with the Building Safety Act started with the bill, when I sort of looked at it from a company perspective as to how it would impact the sort of principal designer role within what we do in CDM. And the more I looked at it, the more I realised it has very little impact on what we do in CDM principal designer, and the greater impact is on sort of everybody around us, from project management, design, to procurement, to our clients and so on. So we sort of set up a cross-company collaboration steering group between Atkins and Fayton and Gould, from a professional services and from a design services, sort of to look at it from two perspectives. And we've got a structure in place now where we're looking at what the impact will be on the business and how we can continue to deliver our services. So that's kind of where my sort of role with the Building Safety Act started.
Hello everyone, my name's Rory Helder. I'm the client director. I work for Marsh, which is the insurance brokers to Wilmot Dixon. I'm a client director, so I look after their insurance programmes. In relation to the Building Safety Act, obviously there's quite significant insurance implications, and really it's very interesting to us because we look down the line as to how we can possibly provide cover and support Wilmot Dixon in what they do, and also with regards to who they deal with.
Good afternoon, everyone. James Bainbridge. I run the professional indemnity placement team within Marsh Insurance Brokers Construction Division in London. Been in that division for 11 years. Been running that team for four. Seen quite a few challenges over the last 5-6 years or so with regard to professional indemnity and concerns in the construction space specifically. So, imagine following the presentation already we've had this afternoon, might have a few questions about what's going on in our world. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tony Norris. I am a lawyer at Geldards, a law firm in Cardiff in the Midlands, and I head up our infrastructure and construction team. In relation to the Building Safety Act, I guess the retrospective liability of 30 years is something a lot of developers and participants in the industry have been particularly concerned about. Also then how to deliver successful projects. I think there's some bricks in the road as we go through this. But also got a role with constructing excellence, and we've recently been talking about how the industry is responding to the Act and what some people are doing, and also what some people are not doing, actually, which is quite disappointing, but we'll talk about that a bit later, perhaps.
Good afternoon. I'm Andrew Dobbs, new business director with Wilmot Dixon, and amongst this esteemed panel, I'm probably the fraud here, so I don't really have any expertise in the Building Safety Act, but my role is really to actually take this very complex area of change and to start to try and position this for ourselves in terms of the adapting and changing products and services we put out into the market, and to really align them to solving customer problems. So the challenge for us is taking what you've heard this afternoon and how do we adapt all of the products and services that we provide to seamlessly take these into the markets, and that's the sort of challenge that I have, really.
Thanks, everyone. So obviously what we heard a lot about earlier, I'm sure a lot of you were thinking, you know, what does that mean to me in my practice? How are we going to move forward with whatever? And I personally heard so much talk about the insurance market, about consultants not being able to get cover, having carve-outs for fire, and you know, does the policy give the project what it really needs? Project insurance, high levels of professional indemnity cover, self-insurance, all that. So can you have a think if there's anything particular you want to talk about? But I would really love to hear from Rory and James initially, if I can, to say what's going on, what's your take on the effect of the Act and what's going on today? And probably, I think everybody would like to know, where do you see this going in the future? Is that okay? Do you mind if you guys come in on that one?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thanks ever so much for having us along this afternoon. It was really terrific to hear a client talking so openly about the concerns and the issues and how they're addressing the Insurance Act, Safety Act, should I say, going forward. The Act itself, I think, has been largely well received by insurers, cautiously optimistic, positively cautious, however you want to sort of put a spin on it. I think from the issues that we've seen in the market post-Grenfell, the volume of claims, concerns, and everything that's come out from first starting off with the cladding position onto fire safety and everything in between, the Act itself going forward is absolutely a positive position for insurers, that clear lines of accountability and responsibility and taking ownership as an industry in terms of the building of these properties going forward. So we've not seen, as Marsh, certainly from our portfolio, the sort of knee-jerk reaction that perhaps contractors and consultants saw post-Grenfell. I think there's a willingness certainly from the professional indemnity market to acknowledge the steps that are being taken by the contractors' world to address these issues. So the outlook going forward, looking at everything that's presented to us today, is a lot more positive. So certainly green shoots going forward. I think the only area of concern potentially is obviously the 30-year liability period, which is being presented to the market. But I think, you know, that's been in place now for a year or so, or certainly for a number of months now. We have not seen from our side of things that leading to another whole raft of issues and claims and circumstances notified out of the construction space. I think, you know, going back 30 years, contracting standards were different perhaps, record keeping as well. You know, we don't expect there to be the raft of concerns and problems that there were certainly post-Grenfell, when we had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of projects notified on a precautionary basis, so many of which now are leading to, you know, legitimate claims. So I think it's not doom and gloom. The Building Safety Act is a real positive. I think if you read some of the press coming out of certain insurance forums like the Professional Indemnity Forum and the IUA, you know, there's a lot more willingness, I think, on the part of insurers to try and work with the contractors. You know, those hard line exclusions that were brought in post-Grenfell for many contractors, particularly in the supply chain, who are really at the nub of it, you know, when the hard market turned. I think go forward, we're probably looking at slightly more positive marketplace and appetite towards construction. But equally, you know, they're, hasten to say, a soft market. We've been through the hard part, certainly, and it's definitely improving. But I think there is that a lot of caution. But again, still because of the volume of matters that were notified to insurers after Grenfell, and those, as I say, those projects are many of which where the rectification works are being undertaken. You know, insurance is being looked at to help support there, and there's still a lot of matters to be worked through.
I think the point to mention is that really we're talking professional indemnity insurance more than anything else, and you know, I think James will probably back this, but we were sort of thinking there might be blanket exclusions and conditions. Cladding was obviously very restrictive in respect of, you know, when Grenfell first happened, but since the Building Safety Act, that hasn't actually happened.
No, just to be a little bit careful, so we, you know, we're As a team, we're based out of the London organisation. Predominantly our clients, as they've been in the tier one, tier two space. The majority of those types of client have been able to retain a modicum of cover when it comes to cladding and fire safety, rectification costs and what have you. It's further down the tier, probably more in the regional subconsultant, subcontractor space, where you've seen those real, real hard line exclusions be brought in for cladding and fire safety, you know, where there hasn't been there's no room for negotiation. This is being put on your policy, take it or leave it sort of attitude. What we are definitely seeing now, and again, you know, we speak from quite a privileged position working at Marsh and with the portfolio that we have, is that insurers are a lot more open to the conversation about writing back in cover for cladding and fire safety on a go forward basis for new projects that are incepting. From renewal dates, contracts that are signed after renewal date of your policy. So, I mean, it's definitely steps in the right direction. They don't want to be picking up any old legacy projects, which might be of a concern, but from a go-forward basis, whether your broker is Marsh or one of the others, you know, that's a conversation that you should be able to have with your broker, looking at things on a go-forward basis. And, you know, recent press from the International Underwriting Association shows that the insurance market is trying to work with the government and with their client base to, on a go-forward basis, be a bit more flexible when it comes to these concerns. And you know, and the Building Safety Act is a part of that.
Great. So any queries around the insurance world then? Any questions, anything on anyone's mind?
Neil?
Yeah.
Neil, before we jump out to the crowd or our guests here today, the one thing that often gets picked up, I meet lots of employers, agents, project managers, cost managers, consultants, architects that are customers in the room here actually engage to bring forward their schemes. But the one comment that we regularly have is that their insurance premiums, particularly PI, is skating north up as much as 35%. Now that's, if you look at maybe some of the universities, that they've been probably dormant for probably 3 or 4 years because of the impact of the industry as such. So now they're beginning to spend real money now. So they're bringing schemes forward. So the real cost to the industry is again spiraling upwards. And I just wondered, is that a real position that you're seeing, because obviously you sit as a broker in between the insurance providers and the consultants, is that a real fact?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the hard market that we saw 2 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, in fact, which ran for the better part of 36 months, you know, you talk about 35% premium increase, you know, we saw 500% premium increases out in the regions, you know, absolutely, you know, brutal stuff. Bad underwriting practices, quite frankly, out in the regions. Uninsurers, you know, you know, writing for premium and doing things, you know, which they shouldn't have been doing. Really, really tough, and particularly because in the consultant space or in the subcontractor space as well, you know, those weren't the guys who were having the problems. You know, the issues really in the marketplace were probably from some of the tier one contractors, and in fact, some of that was touched on a little bit earlier this afternoon in terms of, you know, low margins and what have you. You know, moving into areas where perhaps didn't have the specialty. I don't mean Wilmot Dixon, just mean in general, in that pursuit of growth. You know, the market was turning before Grenfell. There were already problems that we were seeing in PI. It was already under a huge amount of scrutiny. So it wasn't just Grenfell that drove things. I mean, that sped things up, certainly. But the industry itself, professional indemnity, and as probably as, you know, in related working with construction and contractor clients, we're kind of in it together a little bit, I think. We saw huge amount of challenges, massive premium increases, cuts in cover, excesses going up, market withdrawal, terms not even being offered. That has definitely turned, you know, now. I think any broker who's still calling it a hard market at the moment, I would disagree with that. It's definitely softened. It's definitely, rates are coming down. There's a lot more competition. You know, Marsh, just speaking for ourselves, there's 32 people, panel 32 insurers writing construction for us, you know, and there is real competition again now, you know, so it's really important that you are testing what you're being told, whether it's by, you know, a broker or consultant, because, you know, we're certainly seeing a lot more improvement in the PI market, a lot more willingness to look at cover and look at solutions going forward. And, you know, premium, in some cases, premium savings as well now. You know, again, got to be cautious. You know, it's not a one fits all. You know, every risk is looked on its own basis, but certainly a much more improving market space. And some of those, if you're still seeing insurers pushing heavy rate increases, you need to be questioning that.
Just to caveat that very much claims driven though. You know, if it's a consultant that's got a really poor claims record, then you're still going to have difficulties. You know?
Still have some difficulties in terms of your price is going to be looked at and what have you. But the market's not running away like they did 5 years ago. I think there was 12 insurers who just packed their bags and we're not writing this product anymore. So we obviously have clients with concerns. Whatever they might be, whether it's cladding, fire safety, or just other, traditional PI claims. Market's not leaving them in the lurch. You know, their insurers are talking about long-term relationship. You know, it's a long-term product. Claims made, long tail. We work with insurers who are going to be there, hopefully, through thick and thin. You know, not every market ran to the hills. A lot of them are stuck with us through soft and hard market as well, but it isn't. It certainly isn't the doom and gloom that it was a few years ago. I don't think there's many brokers who are quite ready to come out with aggressive white papers saying it's a soft market again. But from what we've seen in the last 18 months, it's a much, much more positive outlook.
Okay, thanks, James.
Yeah. All right, good. So any other questions? So we'll move on into some other wider topics. Yeah, Jim?
I was just wondering, does the insurance company take responsibility for improving the industry? I mean, ultimately, if you won't give contractors or consultants that don't have the right process and procedures in place insurance, then they can't carry out work. So do insurance companies take that responsibility to ensure, they're insuring good companies effectively?
Yeah, I suppose, it's how you put yourself across, isn't it? I mean, if you're just a proposal form going across a desk, you might not get viewed as positively as a client who's able to come in, meet the market, and present and sell themselves. And I'd say, if we were able to present that to the insurers for every one of our clients, that would be, terrific. But that's not always, it's not practical, is it, to have, you might be one for a tier one client and they can come in and present for a week and show off all their wares. It's something, you know, quite different for a, you know, for a regional subby who, you know, hasn't got that time and is not able to. So, you know, every broker at the moment will be saying, meet the market, present, you know, you've got Zoom Teams now and it's so much easier. You don't have to come down from up north to, you know, to visit London and do all of that. But yeah, the more that you can sell yourselves, demonstrate what you're doing, your risk management process, that you understand these concerns going forward and what you're doing to address them, you're going to be looked at in a lot more positive, you know, light. You know, but it isn't, it's easy for us to say, but it's not easy for every, you know business in this industry to be able to do that. That said, again, you know, there's absolutely more competition. And a bit more appetite and a willingness from the insurance market, I think, particularly PI, where they have these working parties. And you know, PI has obviously been through, you know, a bit of a shooing through the construction press and the insurance press in the last 5 years, and there's that acknowledgement that, you know, going forward they have to address some of these issues. And you know, we are seeing that with the cladding and fire safety cover piece.
Thank you.
Alan, did you have a question?
Yeah, hi there. Alan Jarvey from Atkins, so consultancy side. So, do you think there's a bit more the insurance market can do to educate maybe some of our clients? I'm thinking in my world just around PII, it's definitely about indemnity insurance. And what, you know, some of the issues around each and every claims and limits of liabilities. Actually, that's you know, we're having to make tough decisions about what work we go for and what we don't, because there's a lack of understanding what that actually means.
Yeah. I mean, I think the insurance market is quite content to just leave that to the brokers to deal with, quite frankly. Each and every claim, aggregate limits, indemnity, reinstatement, it's all the jargon. You know, what that all actually means, that's really what Rory and I, I suppose, are here for, because, you know, they'll view that as our job. These are the terms and conditions. You go and tell the clients why that's, you know, why we're in the position that we're in. Really, really difficult. I mean, most of our clients hadn't been on each and every claim cover for donkey's years. Most of them was aggregate limits with reinstatements, but the consultants are still getting each and every claim, and the lawyers are still getting each and every claim. You know, so you get to contract reviews and things like that, and they're saying, you know, the lawyers are saying, well, you can still get each and every claim cover. You can't, but you can get this product, and it works a little bit differently, but it does the same thing. I think, you know, Tuesday and Wednesday this week, there is the Professional Indemnity Forum going on up in Cambridge, where certain insurers get together and have a bit of a powwow and talk about how they see the market.
That doesn't sound right. We're not allowed to do that.
Do you know what I mean? So, you know, yeah.
That's a collusion, isn't it?
So, I think it would. They should certainly open the doors up more to clients prospects to talk through. But maybe talking about it a little bit out there before we came in today about, you know, would be quite nice to have an insurer or two on the panel today. I mean, they might get a bit of booting from one or two of you, I suspect, but. You know, we know a few. You can talk through a little bit more clearly why things have shifted so much, you know, as they did late 2017, late 2018. They might actually get a little bit of sympathy from a few people if they actually sort of front it up a little bit more about what the problems have been, because it isn't just from Grenfell that the market turned so much. But ultimately they leave it to the brokers to do the dirty work, I think, and explain why things have got to where they have. You know, luckily enough, Rory and myself, working for an organisation like Marsh, you know, we've got all the data, we've got the claims issues, we've seen what's been going on in the build-up to that tragedy. And that's not as easy for a regional broker or to explain to their, you know, to their clients what's been going on and why we've got to the place that we have.
In answer to your question, our job is to educate as your brokers.
So don't forget, guys, if there's anything you want to talk about this later on in the bar or over dinner, the guys would be delighted to talk to you about it. I'd like to bring Tony in
if the question is, perhaps could there be an easier characterisation of the wording, perhaps, because I think, like bonds over the years, the wording's always been like that, and so we've accepted that's the way the wording is, so... No, possibly, I'd agree with that. We get junior lawyers coming in and we get given brokers' notes, like hundreds of brokers' notes, and they're all written slightly differently, and someone will have anyone claiming in the aggregate, and then you'll see a lot of junior lawyers saying, what is that? Is that this type or that type? So, but do you think maybe some sort of redrafting of the characterisation?
Yeah, no, the insurance industry doesn't do itself. We were talking at the start of this afternoon about how the construction industry is maybe a little bit behind the times. I think it's probably certainly true of the insurance industry with its reputation as well, particularly for us in London, you know, deals down the pub and all this sort of stuff. You know, there is a lot of jargon and what does that mean and what does that mean? And I don't think we know that means the same thing as what something else means, but it's just a different way of phrasing it. You know, it's really, you know, we don't do ourselves, I think, many favours sometimes when it comes to terminology, contracts, wordings, how they're reviewed. You know, so yeah, I think as Rory quite rightly says, it's, you know, for us as brokers to try and, you know, to educate us, you know, as much as we can. But again, it's a very, very big industry, and getting everybody on the same page, not straightforward. But feels like it's improving at this point.
Thanks, James. Now, Tony, I'd like to bring Tony in again if I can, because I know that you chaired a round table recently, didn't you, with the Construction Excellence Group?
Yeah,
so you
cash,
had
yeah.
representatives from customers, supply chain, from designers, contractors and manufacturers and so on. And again, this event is all about sharing knowledge, bringing it into the room. And I'd love to know, what was the flavour of that round table discussion? What actually came out of it? Anything meaty or interesting? Be good to
yeah,
share.
I think very similar to today's debate. I think, as I hinted at in the introduction, the good thing was it was a big cross-section, and I think that's always good to have the industry talking at all different levels, particularly insurance as well. The big surprise to me was there were two or three people in the room that had not heard of the Building Safety Act, other than they'd seen it in the press. That deeply worried me, actually. Because for me, it's probably one of the biggest things that's hit the industry since maybe the Construction Act. I mean, this act started off as a small act, and it sort of tripled in size within a matter of months. And the industry wasn't really consulted about that. I think the House of Lords took it away and wrote it, and then just dropped it back onto the industry and said, there you go, guys, this is what you're working with. So I think there's been a bit of catch-up in relation to that. There's a fair bit of nervousness about the regulatory side, and we talked about competency, but about how competent the regulator might be. So you've got the HSC England, you've got Wales local authorities, and Wales has had the SAB regulator in relation to sustainability, urban drainage stuff, and that, as we are being recorded, that didn't go as well as it could have done. The early days was clunky, slow, and I think that was a big concern that came out loud and clear, was whether the public sector was actually ready to deliver. And I know that you're working with you know, the potential regulators, and I think that's a good thing to do, because we've got a bit of time left to actually get that going. But that was one concern. I think the other concern linked to that was, you know, Building Control have never been responsible for failures in buildings, and inspectors aren't responsible, although I think there's debate at the moment about whether inspectors should carry some responsibility. And so we've got developers with projects that have had Building Control sign off, when frankly the Building Control officers just not even bothered looked in the roof. If they'd have looked, they'd have seen the problem. And yet the problem seems to be, I'm going to use the word, dumped on the private sector to solve. But actually, as you said earlier, James might have said it earlier, the public sector is very much part of this problem, and we can't do it in separate silos. We've got to do it together. So there is an argument about whether there should be some more responsibility in relation to that. There was deep concern about the 30-year retrospective liability and how that would impact upon people's balance sheets, particularly contractors. And it reminded me a wee bit of the change in the environmental legislation, where clients had assets that had contaminated land, and those assets just became liabilities overnight, and that really does smash a hole in your balance sheet. And I think there'll be a lot of that to come through. And what else I had to write them down? Oh, the performance specification change, you know, the value engineering. You know, there was an argument really about whether design and build and the benefits of it have largely gone, where you've got maybe a challenge of regulator, who's going to want to take the risk of changing during the project where you've got to stop at practical completion, and who's going to take responsibility for that stop at practical completion. I know all the funders will expect the contractor to take that responsibility, but will a contractor want to take on design changes or product changes, etc.? So I think that will have an impact, and that's got to be worked through. And I think we'll find the regulators maybe a little bit stiff at the start, not wanting to be the one to make those changes. But I think overall, perhaps without my constructing excellence hat on as a lawyer, what I see probably connects with what you said earlier about risk and reward. And I think the risks have got greater, and probably rightly so for the industry, because let's face it, we kind of created the problem and we're being told to resolve it. But I think the margins have been eroding over the years, that there's now this question about, is there risk and reward for what we're doing? Perhaps the buildings, the assets are going to cost more because we've got to put the quality back in. And I think that's where I was quite pleased to see the slide about the quality initiative. I know I worked years ago as a baby lawyer down the road on Colston Avenue, and John Lang Construction doing a hospital, and their own testing inspection team came in, and they were worse than the expert engineer they'd appointed. And they condemned the work. And I think that's the sort of thing where you go, okay, John Lang, pretty good contractor. I know they went the wrong way on a few GMPs, but you really want that quality. I've got some work with a German waste contractor, and they're pretty much the same. If they don't like what they've installed, they take it back out again and put it back in again, because they don't care what the client thinks. It's for their pride of quality. So I think it's got to be this push towards quality. That was sort of a snapshot.
Good. And, you know, picking up on that quality, and it is so important. A lot of our supply chain partners, they say, crikey, you want us to jump through hoops, is this, is that, and the other. But ultimately, when I'm speaking to them outside the work environment, they say, do you know what? It's great working for you guys, because we know we ain't going back again, because it's absolutely right, you know. So whilst it's painful and it takes longer, it's absolutely the right thing for the industry, for businesses, and for our customers at the end of the day, that we don't have these defects being built in. So really important.
Neil, can I just, Richard, principal designer, that's where your life is spent. So what do you see happening in your world now? Is that greater liability coming in? Does that put pressure on you within the construction process?
Well, I think it's probably worth starting with the fact that I think, you know, the Building Safety Act applies to all works where the building regulations apply, and part of that includes having a principal designer and a principal contractor. So for any works where the building regulations apply, you'll have to have a principal designer under the Building Safety Act and a principal contractor under the Building Safety Act as well. And the principal designer under the CDM regulations, I think the intention always was that would be the lead designer that would lead the design in the same way that the principal contractor does during construction. But because of a lack of appetite, I think, within the design world or you know, appetite towards risk, I don't think that ever really happened the way that it was intended to. And, you know, from a personal perspective, I suppose Dame Judith Hackett oversaw the change of the CDM regulations in 2015, and she's overseeing the change the Building Safety Act. And I think the intention is really that the principal designer under the Building Safety Act is, as it would be under the CDM regs, is the designer that will lead the design during the pre-construction stage and through to any design changes as well. And I think if you look at the PAS standard for the principal designer in terms of competencies, the PAS standard 8671 is, it's light, it doesn't give you detail, it's not prescriptive, but it tells you the sort of attributes that the principal designer would have to have. And it's, you know, not just being able to record and coordinate design changes, it's being able to actually challenge and appraise the design. So it's really having a good in-depth understanding of the building regulations and the building safety and fire legislation that impacts what you're building. And that applies, I think, proportionately. So if you're working on a higher rise, a higher risk building, then that level of competence, that skills, knowledge and those experiences, that needs to be far greater. Whereas if you're working on just school extensions, obviously it will be scaled down to meet the sort of requirement. So, from my perspective as a CDM principal designer, that's where my career has been. It's not something I'm going to be jumping straight into and saying I'll be the Building Safety Act principal designer on your project. I think from a from an organisational perspective as well. You know, the principal designer can be a person or it can be an organisation. You know, for these larger sort of projects where, you know, Atkins and probably Wilmot Dixon, I think you'd probably be looking at how you fulfil that role in an organisational capability, how you have the processes, systems set up within your organisation to be able to deliver the principal designer role. You know, ties into probably your yellow book, and you know, you might have to review that and how you'd look to do that as a contractor. That's what you were looking to do to deliver. Design and build, obviously that got a lot of attention during the consultation process. How do you manage design change on a design and build when it hasn't got to go through a gateway again, if it's gone through gateway two? And that is, I think, where the HSC or the building safety regulator have been looking for the principal contractor to start to take on the building Building Safety Act principal designer role during construction. So, yeah, it's definitely a role that's going to have a lot more accountability, a lot more rigour to it, and you're going to really need to know your onions to be able to do that role, I think. Yeah.
Helen, can I just turn to you a second? you sat across the table to your preferred consultants, and you listen to what they say, and you're looking at your task in hand, and you're thinking, do I trust these characters to keep me out of jail and my institution? Does that worry you? Because you link that with procurement also, and we're sort of, you know, when I'm out in the marketplace and I'm saying to Andrew, this is a good job, this is, and one of the first things that he'll say to me, so when's the procurement strategy coming into place, Nigel? And I'll say, it's going to be about another 6 months yet, and I've been following that job maybe for 12 months. And then the first thing that sort of concerns us is the consultants, and possibly you're making decisions as like Sir Richard, Robin, and they're trying to decide what they're going to commission those consultants up to. Are they going to take a REBA 01, or are you going to be bold and go for a REBA 3, or even push a REBA 4? The market now, and you look at what we are, our toes curl actually when we've been told that it's likely to come out at REBA 4. You know, it could get worse, it could be single stage at REBA 4, it could be worse. But what will you do going forward? Because when you think of the implication of the Building Safety Act, does it make you feel comfortable or uncomfortable?
This is a hot potato, isn't it?
It is.
That's why you're here.
Not to dodge the question, but I think we're concerning ourselves with is how you demonstrate that competence. So your colleague, your peer from F&G, talking about the PASS standard. We're looking at all of our scopes of service and thinking, crikey, how are we going to be able to demonstrate the decisions that we've made to put in place the design team, and then it comes to at what stage do they finish the job and when the contractor might take it on. So it's work in progress, Nigel.
Okay, I'll accept that for what it is at the moment. But what I would also do is to, Steve, I'm just going to turn my attention over to Fulkers, doing some really exciting jobs at the moment, some high value jobs. When you're in front of your customers and you may be in a position that you've got to initially set a procurement strategy looking for your consultants, does the impact of the Building Safety Act start to make yourselves a little bit crikey? This does put us at either a strong position or in a nervous state, because you know that the journey, and quite often taking the design forward, and often we see architects who want to be particularly flamboyant, and some of the challenges that we often face is it buildable? Because first challenge that you've got to do is arrive at a budget that you think you may be able to build that building for. So where's your head taking you in this moment in time?
Start being engaged in some of these conversations, start understanding early and get the collaboration with your guys early so we can bringing them into the procurement strategy and start developing how that works, how the project goes.
Neil, I don't know whether you want to jump in at that, because procurement is something that, you know, we spend a lot of time on this topic, and the market has been buoyant now for probably 3 or 4 years, and I would probably look at the consultants, and all through COVID, probably the pressure on your resources are probably greater than what you've seen probably in the decade prior to that. So when we get to put ourselves into a position, which projects that we're targeting, Andrew's dilemma then, are we going to bid? Where's your head at, Andrew?
I think if you, I'm going to just draw you back to probably the slide James put up, I think, because that's probably where we can sort of start tying this stuff back. And I never thought I'd be sitting here defending the insurance industry. But, you know, when you look at that sort of web of failure, that's what we're trying to insure. You know, the contractual relationships on Grenfell were probably pretty typical of most contracting projects, right? It's and when we look at failure, and when we have failures, we've never had failures of that significance. But you know, when things go wrong, what you start to realise is this house of cards that we design, construct, and procure on, and you start to realise there's very little control in that system at all, and it unravels at a rapid rate of knots, and you could. That sort of web of failure, if you would probably be pretty typical of most projects that went wrong. That's what we're trying to ensure. It was interesting your points about the market is getting easier and the importance to you of the Building Safety Act. And this is the opportunity, because you know what does an actuary sitting in an insurance company look for? Understanding of risk. So if we can say to them, look, we're taking this risk out, we've got standard details for this, we can do this, we're checking this stuff out. This is taking cost, this is adding efficiency in, this is creating productivity. These are all opportunities for a future construction, a model of design, procurement, a construction model that are absolutely essential, because the, you know, at its extreme, this sort of Russian roulette we've been playing really with design and procurement for since Noah was a boy is just not sustainable, and we are all at a point now where the resources are just not there anymore either. So we can't, if you look at the implications, if we've talked about today of the Building Safety Act, as Richard and the team talked about, the levels of compliance, the amount of time we're going to have to spend in pre-construction verifying this stuff, and rightly so, by the way. That takes time, and we need to work together to find the most expeditious and efficient way of doing that together. And it's about productivity, it's about efficiency. And every time we do that, insurance will get cheaper as well, because we're taking risk out. And we can sit down with these guys and say, look, this is how this thing is built. You get to, you know, imagine a future where we've got a golden thread through every project, you know, and being able to demonstrate that with the degree that the our guys took you through today, you think you'd be sitting there with these guys. You tell me what the risk is, right? You know, why am I paying this level of premium now when I've got this level of compliancy? It's, you know, it feels like, I think Richard mentioned, you know, we are a regulated sector. There's this understanding now going forward that buildings kill people. You know, you wouldn't design an aircraft, I wouldn't get on a plane that had gone through a construction design a design process, and it's this understanding that, you know, these things are serious, and the only way to do it is this level of control and this level of detail and compliancy. And although it feels hard, and it has felt hard for us, it will, I think, it is a real important turning point, as Tony said, in terms of the significance of this legislation in changing people's behaviours and approaches to construction, and I think that's why it's going to inevitably change procurement, but it'll change it for the better. And it'll make it more productive, it'll make it more efficient, it'll make all the things that we want of it. It'll be clearer from a cost point of view. All of these things are benefited. I'm sure it's not going to be a straightforward journey by any stretch of the imagination, but there's certainly, if you look at what we're able to do in a very quite, we've done some amazing buildings in a very unproductive way. Imagine what we can do when you channel that in the right ways, take this waste out, be productive, and drive sustainable growth. And I think that's, it's quite a significant nexus point, I think, for the change of the industry in the next 10 years.
Well said. The two things I'd like to do, I want to bring Jez in. How do you keep Wilmot Dixon out of litigation with our products, DFMA, MMC, so you work in the national product team.
Yep.
And then I want to link that back to Tony, because litigation silos, so this is our challenge, particularly at this stage.
Yeah.
It's not easy,
yeah.
And it'd be very easy in these early stages of the introduction of the BSA to become defensive and lose sight of what partnering is really all about, and hopefully how we can take it as a step forward for the industry, which I think is going to be the challenge. Jez, can you talk on that, please?
Okay, so I mentioned earlier that we review all the projects, and we review them at various stages. Sometimes they're stage one, sometimes they're stage four. And the first thing we look for is we look at compliance with our policies. So we've got a very strict fire policy. Our fire policy generally is trying to drive our business to be a non-combustible business, but we've got limited exceptions. One thing we look for is tested solutions. So we're looking that we've chosen the right products, and that's regardless of form of actual procurement. So we have got traditional projects in our business, recladding projects, where we are still challenging the products that have been used, because we have to make sure that what we build conforms to the building regulations. So the principal designer has to make sure that if you build it, it's designed in accordance with the building regs. We, regardless of procurement, we have to make sure we've built it in accordance with the building regulations. So when we do our reviews, we are very careful to try and see where this project is going, what level the information's at, and what products have been chosen, and we will advise where you should possibly look at alternatives. The other thing is our yellow book. Our yellow book picks up our learning. So it picks up what we've done right and what we've done wrong over the years, and we've got mandated rules in our yellow book. So in our yellow book design, it will say you will use this type of cavity barrier in this instance. In our yellow book build, we've got you will build it using the right people, and you will take the right records to demonstrate you've done it correctly. So we've set up a very, very good process, and we are constantly learning, we're constantly evolving. One thing I'd like to add to the conversation that's been had so far is that the gateway process obviously is only going to apply to the in-scope buildings at the start, so there's going to be a lot of buildings that you won't need to worry about the gateway process. It's the timescales for those gateway processes I think we're going to need to get used to as an industry. We've got Gateway 1, which is done. Gateway 2, from that solid application that says, this is how I'm dreaming I'm going to build this building, I've given you all the information, you've got to give the regulator 12 weeks, if you're lucky, to come back and say, yep, I'm happy, crack on. Then there's the Gateway 3, which is, okay, now prove that you did it in accordance with Gateway 2, plus all the agreed changes. And then, once you've got the Gateway 3 completion certificate, someone's got to register the building for occupation. That's another process. It's another bit of time. It's another thing that we need to get used to. And one thing about the building, another thing about the Building Safety Act is that in-scope definition can be changed overnight. At the moment it's 18 metres. The direction of travel is 11. Care homes will probably come in quite soon. It's flexible. It's like that. And my view is that once the HSE, Building Safety Regulator, and we have got used to this way of doing business, it will probably encompass everything we do. It will become the new way of working.
And the collaborative approach is going to be essential. You can't do a gateway to application without all the design being finalised. Now that means either someone sits down and works out what they think they're going to do, or you involve the supply chain, the consultants, the right people, and actually debug that design at gateway two.
Actually accept what you say, and in fairness, I think you will no doubt straighten, should we say, the Wilmot Dixon, our processes, and even greater to what it is today. And I know how strong it is, because with the ops directors, some of the pain that they often feel when they're trying to build projects is tough. Tony, if I just come to you.
Yeah.
Slight concern to me is the defensive action that quite often we necessarily get ourselves involved with, and liability silos. What does that mean to you going forward? Do you see, because obviously we're talking Egan, we're talking Latham, we're talking collaboration, we're talking partnering. Is that real, or is this just an impossible dream?
Oh, crikey. I mean, my journey started here, actually, about 20 years ago. And all I ever did was litigation claims. And, you know, after a while, you really get upset by people saying, great job, we hope we'll never see you again. So I put a white cloak on and became Gandalf of Oz, you know, and did project work. But I have seen the industry slowly going back to where it was about 30 years ago. And, you know, when I first started, we were talking about minus 2% margin on jobs. And I said, how does that work? And they said, well, it'd be a loss and expense claim, you know. And so everything, all the hospitals around here, they were all loss and expense claims. And then 10 years later, there was a defects claim, you know. So my fear for the industry, and this is why my one word answer was concerned, and I am concerned for the industry, because the Building Safety Act is, and I don't think anybody's used this phrase yet, so I claim copyright on it. It's like the Liam Neeson quote, you know, I will find you. It doesn't matter where you are and who you are, if you've been involved somewhere along the line, we're going to cut through all the corporate structures and we're going to find you, we're going to come after you. So as a lawyer, that is fantastic news if you're on the back end of a claim, not because we make money, look, we make money from litigation, but it means we've got so many other avenues to offload for contribution. Before, we didn't have that. The law of tort cut us out, the Defective Premises Act, usually we had limitation coming out of it. So my concern is that it'll be quite destructive, that there will be a lot of litigation. I'll give you an example. If you're doing a technology court piece of litigation, you're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds of lawyers' costs, if not millions of pounds in lawyers' costs. Even I'm astounded by how much litigation costs these days. And I don't think that's what the industry should be doing, which is, you know, setting aside on your balance sheet, you know, legal costs, £2.5 million. We should be redrafting that back in. And I do think we need to put a bit more glue back into it. And push it back towards collaboration. That's why I mentioned to the Marsh guys, literally we're about to come on, whether maybe something like a single project insurance or something like that that prevents people from pursuing each other for liability. I think you didn't agree necessarily, which is fine, but I do want that we need something that stops the industry crucifying each other, I think.
Yeah, no, there are project insurances is still available in the PI market for an annual renewable basis, rather than, you know, if it's a 10-year, 12-year contract requirement, that's really dried up. The insurance market doesn't need the income. They don't need to be locked into a 12-year policy period where they can't adjust terms, conditions, what have you. It will come back as the market goes back down like this, and it will do inevitably, such as life. And then they will want that income. They will start looking at single projects. They will start, you know, thinking, well, that's a nice big chunk of change. We'll take that and start topping up the coffers again. But at the moment, it's still really difficult. I mean, you know, alliance-based contracts are still very, very popular with insurers, absolutely, very much for those reasons. You know, you're all in it together, less finger-pointing. Most of the policies that we place on an annual basis for our clients include alliance term language within them for that very nature. To cover what's more likely to be first-party claims rather than third-party claims. So there's appetite for that, absolutely. locking that in for a long period at the moment. It's not completely off the table, just very, very cautious. Clients that the insurers are familiar with, are comfortable with, got good experiences with, possibly consider it, but we're talking 3 or 4 insurers, you know, who are even allowed to write that type of policy because their reinsurance won't allow for it for many others.
And I don't know whether I'm behind the curve, but NHBC have not yet gone to 15 years, have they? As maybe somebody in the audience knows the answer, but I think they're still at 12 years. So we need a 15-year cover. That's my simplistic view of it. I think if you can get 15-year cover for a building, that you'll stop the industry spending millions in lawyers' costs. You know, we can survive elsewhere, guys. Trust me. We don't need the litigation, but if you give it to us, we'll take it. But I'd rather see the money ploughed into successful projects than, wasted up in the courts in London.
The one thing that I was going to pick on, and Alan and I, we've spoken about this late at night, occasionally when we've had probably too many drinks, but we're talking about self-insurance, and we're talking the big institutions or the big businesses, the likes of Atkins, the likes of Aecon, and self-insuring, and the governance that sits above you in operating, and the resistance and the risk mitigation measures that you have to go through to get maybe a customer's PI aspirations met. So is that a painful sort of process? Are you fed up of fighting up because you know that you've got to meet clients' expectations, or is there always a compromise on the table?
Well, that's a terrible question. Particularly as our insurers, Marsh, same as your insurers. So the big companies like us, you know, we do at times self-insure, you know. It's back to what I was saying earlier about the education. Some of the stuff that we get asked to try and provide for insurance with is just nonsense. And I can bring in things like parent company guarantees and stuff like that. It's just, it's antiquated, some of the stuff that's been asked for. And it's a lack of education in our industry, quite honestly. And I don't know where it's been driven from, because I don't think it's been driven actually from our clients in front of me here. So it's the advice that they're being given. No, but ultimately, quite often, Helen, it's the advice that you've been given as well about what, you know, things like each and every insurance actually means. And you know, it's like I say, there is a lack of understanding and interpretation by many, many organisations about what that really means.
I was trying not to have this discussion because I've got to go. But I think we're all fed up of playing the dance, and I've written some follow-up notes, and I think we need an event, the insurance dance-off, that's what I've called it, because you're fed up of putting those qualifications in, we're fed up of getting those qualifications and playing the dance. So it's long been an aspiration of mine to bring everybody together and almost draw up this table that says, if it's this project of this value, these are the insurances, we're all going to agree, and we sign up to it and stop playing the dance. Because you've said that the market is softening, not from where we're sitting. We're getting more and more non-compliances about changing the insurance levels, and we're not playing the same game. And there's the language you talked about. Is it each and every claim? Is it in the aggregate? Is it revolving, 24-hour revolving? Please, somebody give me a lesson, and my insurance officer and your insurance officer. Let's get us all in the same room and play the same game. If you don't want us to ask for parent company guarantees, what are we going to have instead? We don't want to do the bond, because you might argue the bond is old hat. So what we're going to have instead, are we going to play nicely over the insurances? Because, like, not sure where the risk is going. Because it's the policies are going down, the limits are going down. You don't want the PCGs. It's all going your way, it feels like. So that's my challenge. How do we all take it forward and work together and stop playing the dance off? Don't answer it now.
Yeah, so, I mean, to be honest, for me, it's something we'd happily contribute to in the future session. Yeah, without a doubt. Because it's a distraction as well, isn't it, from the job at work?
It very much is, because typically when, if we look, say, for instance, into the Welsh market, then we're heavily frameworked, public sector, and we then have some real challenging positions, because Tony and I have rubbed shoulders on negative act, shall we say, in trying to get improved PCG position, because typically larger businesses will not sign up to ultimate holding company requirements. And you can see why, but having that discussion when somebody's representing their client and is not prepared to shift, then it's really a demanding environment that we find ourselves in. So we do need to get in the room, and we do need to sort each other out, because if we don't compromise, it will escalate costs, but it'll also stop us building as well, won't it? And I think we all become a casualty of that in the recent years as well.
I think I'm not disclosing any confidences, but with a consultant, it would be unlikely we would ask for a parent company guarantee. It'd be unlikely we'd ask for a bond. But if there was a massive deductible, then that would become part of the question, because you're trying to compare consultants and trying to get a level playing field for that. We have rubbed shoulders on the guarantee. I remember that very clearly. So we've never acted for Wilmot Dixon, by the way. So it's very kind of them to invite me here. a lot of clients are concerned about is future security. So can somebody come back and fix my problem? And the bond is a short-term product and is primarily hooked into insolvency. And there's a lot of insolvency, as we saw on the slide earlier. And there's going to be more people going bust in our industry over the next 12 to 18 months. And I've seen some balance sheets of some contractors. It is quite worrying, actually. So people want security, and they don't know where else to get it from. And that's what I'm saying. You could cut through all of this. You could create a more central insurance product. And whether the market would buy that or not, I don't know. But that's all clients are looking for, is will somebody help me when I've got a problem with my building in 15 years' time?
Yeah, well, firstly, actually, this is an afternoon of first for me. I've found myself supporting an insurance company, insurance
broker.
Industry,
yeah.
And broker, and find myself sitting next to a free lawyer for the afternoon. I think, look, this comes back again. Go back to that web of failure, and all of this stuff is because, and it's the same on the customer client side. You know, their experience of the industry is a reflection of that complexity and that web, right? So their response, we're just on the other side of the same problem. We're all in this dance, and it's so complex that our response has been, well, let's just keep adding more instruments of protection to it. So we got bonds, we got PCGs, we got all this stuff, we got insurance, and actually, it's not really changed. It hasn't changed the fundamental problem we've got. And when we do get failures, the failures are dramatic, and they're extreme. They're Grenfell, but there's countless other failures, you know. We just layered this up. It's like the boiling frog, isn't it? You know, we've been in this industry for a long time, and as soon as we hit a problem, we just add. I'll put another provision in the contract. I'll add another Z clause into this. I'll start amending this. I'll start amending that. You take all the ground risk. You do this. You do that. And all of a sudden, we're just throwing mud at each other contractually, and then eventually, at some point, we end up, shouting at each other. Usually, at some point, the real opportunity to grasp here is that clarity. You know, good process is good process. It's almost, it feels like construction is about 30 different varieties of coffee bean, right? It's all fundamentally coffee, but we have a different. We'll change that procurement a little bit there. It's sort of the same, but it's a bit different. And every time we get one of those, we've got to try and particularly Gemma in the pricing bit. We've got to try and unpick it all and work out what's this different flavour doing to the mix here, and how does that change the taste of the coffee, and. As I said, good process is good process, and this is about taking waste out, and learning from what manufacturing does well, not wholesale building in factories, but taking those principles of good process, productivity, delivers results, and you can see, that compliancy checking. The environment now is such, we've got to not be fearful of this environment, we've got to exploit it for our benefit.
take all the stuff that, you know, the guys and gals have talked about this afternoon and said, right, that is a real opportunity for change. And fundamentally, you know, I mentioned control. It puts us in control. When you're not in control, that's when the lawyers get involved, that's when the insurance get involved. As soon as you get to a point you don't understand risk, you're in a whole new world of pain, aren't you?
So Nigel, the other tactic I'll express is we will frequently put a PCG and a bond out to contractors, particularly in the housing market, not Wilmots and much smaller contractors, because we're trying to flesh out what the financial position of the company is, which we never know because the accounts are like 2 years old and you're looking at an old situation. And you get stories back, which is, oh, we've been three brokers or insurers and nobody will back your bond. And I say, but it's a standard industry bond. They've been using this bond form for 25 years. And then you dig down, and then one case we had, two directors said, well, we'll put £50,000 of our money each into an escrow account. Well, why would you do that? You know, because we don't want to take a bond out. Turns out they've got too many bonds out in the market, and they can't get a bond, you know. So if they'd just been honest with us in the first place, you could have structured something slightly differently. So it's not necessarily us being difficult, it's us trying to tease out what the proper solution should be for the client, yeah?
I didn't mean to put you in a difficult position.
No, I have to give you the honest answers.
The one thing that's sort of remarkable to me today, we got some real industry experts and we got some industry experts in the audience as well, but you're all a little bit quiet, except for Helen, that is an ally. So, and obviously Robin. What you have to take away from today, is this a platform that any of your concerns that you may have in your working environment, this is an opportunity to test these chaps up here. Is there any questions from the audience? Anything that I've got a burning desire to actually launch into them?
Hi, Craig, CMB. That web of blame for me is construction of the last 20 years. Forget the Building Safety Act for a minute. That web of blame is effectively our market is a client. Risk genuinely runs downhill on the client side, so all we do is push risk down through the contracts, to the subcontractor, the subcontractor. We go back to that slide where 42 people on the ground have gone bankrupt because we've pushed all the risk down. I think this Building Safety Act has got to force the industry to work as a team, because what that said to me is actually, I'm a subcontractor, but for the clients in the room, the client is now responsible for their building. From day one, they're the ones going to prison with us. We're all going to go to prison, but they're with us in the same cell. So clients need to procure responsibly and correctly. They need to be able to justify the competence of the contractor they've employed and why they've employed them, taking on board the timescales, program. Main contractor's differentiator at the moment is program, because they only really be cheaper than the next contractor by having a cheaper program and cheaper prelims. So we've got to get back to building with the right timescales, the right quality, stop cutting corners. And I think just by the client having to now demonstrate competence in their own business, otherwise they're joining us in jail, may start driving a team working together, because we're all pretty good at what we do and we can solve most problems together. But when we work in the silos of legal blame, we can't solve anything. And the industry can either come together as a collective or hide behind paperwork to protect themselves, and that's the choice the industry has to make.
Cheers, Craig. I think you must have seen my summary slides. I couldn't have said it better myself. So whilst we can argue the Worker Under Safety Act may seem unfair, particularly the 30 years retrospective thing, parts of it are, may seem difficult and the implications may be unsettling for a lot. I think we all agree, as James said when he was speaking, that it's absolutely the right thing to do. And I think if we use the knowledge that we have, we can capitalise on these opportunities moving forward. And we clearly heard some of the consequences of not getting it right. Therefore, in my opinion, as a few of you said today, there's never been a better time for collaboration, working with those that understand it and on the right page, and we'll go our way through it. And that does say exactly what Craig was saying about getting supply chain involved early, getting the consultants, contractors and customers working together at the earliest stage. Now, I want to thank the panel and thank everybody that has sort of contributed and asked questions. And of course, I want to thank you all for coming this afternoon, and I look forward to carrying on the discussions. So thank you very much. Cheers. We'll be right back.